Since 2010, nearly 18% of the U.S. gross product has been spent on healthcare. In fact, chronic diseases, which include heart disease, cancer, and diabetes, are responsible for 7 of every 10 deaths in America every year. And those diseases account for 75% of the nation's health spending. In fact, the World Health Organization estimates that 80% of non-communicable diseases could be prevented if 4 key lifestyle practices are followed. It seems health organizations are starting to see it that way as well. Joining me live in studio to talk about the changing face of healthcare is Dean Jean Mucci, the Service Line Program Manager at St. Luke's Children's Hospital, Dr. Jennifer Schalls, the Heart and Rehabilitation Medical Director at St. Luke's, and Dr. Alejandro Necochea, an internal medicine physician. Welcome, all three of you, to the program.
Thank you for having us.
First question I would like to start with is, everyone has this, why are health costs going up? Alejandro?
So, you know, if you think about where we're spending our healthcare dollars in the United States, I think the conversation over the last several years has pointed out the fact that we do spend more money than most industrialized countries. And I think part of the reason we spend so much money is actually that we're probably spending in the wrong places. You know, we end up spending a lot of money in places like hospitals, in things like medications, treatments, and things of that nature. And it's not just that we spend more money than other industrialized countries, but we're also not spending enough in some of the areas that we'll talk about more in this today that impact what makes people suffer from the chronic conditions that you pointed out, you know, the chronic conditions that they have now. So I would say that's one big factor, that we're spending a lot in treatment and not so much in prevention. And unfortunately, we're not necessarily getting better. We're not having better outcomes as a result of all the spend.
So then what has changed in that? Because it seems to be that we're slowly starting to try to be proactive with people's health versus, you know, they come into the hospital and they have all of these symptoms, or they, you know, they've waited so long and they've got like a stage 4 cancer or something like that. What's made health organizations all of a sudden, and maybe it hasn't been all of a sudden, decide to become more proactive?
Well, health actually starts in our community. And so healthcare actually only attributes about 11% to somebody's total health. So I think a lot of times we hear health and people assume healthcare. But where we live makes us sick, and it can make us well. So Dr. Schalls and Dr. Necochea could treat somebody in the clinic, but if they go home to an environment where they don't have a safe place to walk, they live in inadequate housing, they don't have access to healthy food, their neighborhood is not a safe place, they live in poverty, they can clinically treat them, but then when they go home to their environment and it doesn't promote health, we see people just continue to spiral and get more ill. So really, if we're starting to understand that when we invest upstream, we can really mitigate how many people we're seeing who are getting chronically ill and really catastrophically ill. So especially if we start with our kids, right? We start early and we start often and we change the trajectory for them. They don't become a big risk pool for us hopefully later on. So we're starting to really understand that those upstream interventions, which people would say, why do hospitals do that? Why would you help get people to grocery stores? Well, we know that diabetes, cancer, a lot of different chronic diseases are really attributable to the food or the lack of food that people eat.
So, Jean, explain upstream, so, because you've used that term twice, and I'm sure there are a lot of people saying, upstream, what does that have to do with healthcare? What does that term mean?
So those are really, we're trying to address the social determinants of health that really are those conditions that people are born into. So where they're born, where they live, where they grow up, where they age. So things that they can't necessarily impact or predict. I didn't ask to be born in New York or be a woman. Mm-hmm. I can't change that. So when the environment or the neighborhood they live in, when there's social disparities, such as poverty, lack of opportunity for education, lack of access to healthy foods. Those are those kinds of things that we're looking at, and we're calling those upstream, addressing those social determinants so that if we can keep them healthy, Dr. Necochea and Dr. Schalls don't have to treat them when they're chronically or catastrophically ill.
And Dr. Schalls, have you seen that over the years in what you practice in medicine? Is there a difference where people live and how healthy they are?
Well, absolutely. What Jean is talking about are the social determinants of health. They're really the number one areas that need to be addressed first before people can then continue to work upstream and address these other areas more specifically, like getting enough physical activity, getting the right types of healthy foods, getting the right sleep, managing their stress. You know, it's very difficult for patients that I've seen who are living in crisis or don't have access to safe areas, who don't have transportation to grocery stores. It's definitely, you have to start with the social determinants of health. But absolutely, the next step is, which is upstream work, is really educating the public and as well as healthcare providers on the power that is in healthy behaviors, your day-to-day decisions, your habits.
We're speaking with Jean Mutchie with St. Luke's Children's Hospital, Dr. Jennifer Schultz, a lifestyle medicine physician, and Dr. Alejandro Necochea, an internal medicine doctor. We're talking about community health and how we have an upstream mentality. If you would like to be part of the conversation, email us if you have questions or comments. You can do that at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. You can tweet us, KBSX 91.5, or on our Facebook page, Boise State Public Radio. Jean, I'd like to get back to the comment that you made about our children. How do we do this with our kids, especially if the social economics aren't necessarily on your side?
We have to advocate. We have to use our voices. I call this the year of being bold and brave. Policies, systems, and environmental change are really big indicators for our kids. They don't get a choice generally in what they eat, where they live. The stressors or the lack thereof that happen in their home environment. So really, for many of our kids, school is their safe haven. And so as providers, too, we're looking at wrapping supports around the schools. We know that they're there for a good majority of their day. Parents trust the school. So it's a great place to bring a clinical bridge in with a healthy platform around physical activity. We also know that data clearly show that active kids learn better. So if we can create an active environment, change policy systems and environments, and then on the opposite end, really work with our policymakers so that there is a public-private partnership in how we're addressing this. Private sector hospitals, we cannot do this on our own. We really have to look at things like Medicaid expansion. We have something that's modifiable and avoidable, and that's a health disparity. So for people who fall in the gap, getting them access to health care, preventative care, will hopefully keep our physicians from having to treat them again when they're chronically ill or catastrophically ill. So it really has – there's got to be this real partnership mentality. But really, I think it's collaboration. We need a lot of community partners and our policymakers to really link arms and really look at how we can make our communities a place where health is a shared value.
And to be frank, are we seeing that in Idaho with our policymakers?
Yes.
Good.
In spurts.
In spurts.
I think we really do have to give credit where it's due. And I think part of it is we really have to educate them. A lot of times we just don't know what we don't know. And if they don't have the context around what some of our residents and their constituents are facing, we can't expect them to make decisions that impact that. So really it becomes incumbent on us as community partners to elevate the voice for those who don't have a voice and really make sure that we're making decisions that always create health in all policies. So it starts, I think, with at our community level and then as providers, partners, to really make sure these upstream avenues are being advocated for by a lot of us.
We are continuing our conversation about community health. One of the topics that we have talked a little bit about are four key lifestyle practices that the World Health Organization estimates that 80% of non-communicable diseases could be prevented if we follow these certain practices. In studio with me today to talk about the changing face of healthcare is Jean Mutchie, the Service Line Program Manager at St. Luke's Children's Hospital, Dr. Jennifer Schultz, the Heart and Rehabilitation Medical Director at St. Luke's, and Dr. Alejandro Necochea, an internal medicine physician. Dr. Schultz, I'd like to start this conversation with you and about those four key lifestyle factors that the World Health Organization talks about, and they are following a healthy diet, being physically active, avoiding tobacco, and then consuming alcohol in moderation. These sound simple.
These sound very simple, but aren't they very difficult to do?
I mean, think so.
You know, we literally live and die by our day-to-day decisions with what we're going to do. We literally live and die by our habits. And we live in a culture, especially in the U.S., that doesn't promote daily physical activity, doesn't promote promotes definitely a diet that is high in processed foods. In fact, 63% of the American diet is actually in processed foods. Only 12% of the American diet is in plants or consists of plants, which actually are considered the components that are the healthiest components of a diet. And, you know, there's a lot of factors driving that, including, you know, large corporations and the media and just our general cultural preference. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing for people to make changes when their whole family is eating a certain way, or, you know, when they're in the schools and it's assumed that, you know, that candy is used for reward and fruit juice, which, you know, is used for school get-togethers and things like that, to change that is difficult. And again, to what Jean was talking about, you know, when people are struggling in other areas of their lives or don't have access to these fresher foods that are healthier, even more difficult to make that change.
So how are you encouraging your patients to make these changes? Because they seem simple. You know, drink less alcohol, have a healthier diet, get some exercise, don't smoke.
Well, I would tell you that we start first. We start with education. I think people get information from tons of different sources, and not necessarily always getting sources that are correct, getting correct information. The sources are unreliable. I know that it's difficult as a healthcare provider in a busy practice to take the amount of time out to underline and underscore the impact of healthy behaviors on a person, an individual's chronic disease that they might be coming in for, like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, et cetera. But it's super important to do it. And I'm in a lucky situation because I teach in a lifestyle medicine type of program, cardiopulmonary rehab, where we have the time to really educate people, and we give a consistent message.
And talk to me about lifestyle medicine. This is not a term that I grew up with, but we're hearing it more often these days.
It's definitely a newer term. I mean, I think people have been using lifestyle for thousands of years to treat disease, and we always knew that eating healthy foods was going to result in better outcomes, right? I mean, I think we always kind of knew that. But now there's a formalized College of Lifestyle Medicine, which is really the use of – the definition is really the use of lifestyle interventions to prevent, treat, and actually reverse chronic disease. And it is the chronic disease burden that's pushing up healthcare costs in our country and elsewhere.
And Dr. Nekuchiya, talk about the fact that – you know, we have these factors. If we do this, you know, we'll be healthier. But there are other things within the community that have to happen, correct, to really make this community, this idea of community health, work better. If we're healthy, if our community is healthy, if where we live is healthy, that will make a difference too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, healthcare is not, or health is not necessarily something that just happens or is that is supported by the clinics and the hospitals that we have in the typical health system. Health has to happen in the home, where you work, at school. And so we need to be able to partner with organizations that are supporting patients in all these environments at a policy level, at an advocacy level, with data, et cetera, with funds. And so, you know, as Dr. Charles pointed out, we can give patients a lot of education and a lot of tools, but ultimately, they do go home.
So that only goes so far, though.
Exactly. So fortunately, there are a lot of nonprofit organizations. There are a lot of organizations in Idaho, in the Treasure Valley, that are doing really good work. And they have very good outcomes, and they use evidence-based initiatives to do this work. And so part of our role as health system, our health systems and health organizations, is really to figure out what we can do and also what we cannot do, where we need to partner with these organizations. And so we, every 3 years, we do what is called a community health needs assessment, where we basically try to understand what are the opportunities to improve the health of the communities that where we serve.
And what have you found with that?
So the and not surprisingly, the three main areas, at least in the Treasure Valley, are trying to identify and prevent diabetes and obesity, also mental health and suicide prevention, and of course access to affordable health care. Those are the three big areas that we have identified in the Treasure Valley, and they're actually not very dissimilar with the rest of the state or the country.
That's interesting because I think we're known in Southern Idaho for being active, for living a healthy lifestyle, but we still fall into that risk factor of diabetes and obesity. Why is that?
Because, sure, absolutely. If you live in Boise, you will probably run into a lot of people who are very physically active. They're out there biking and walking, but you know, Boise does not necessarily represent every corner of the state. And if you look and going back to the social determinants of health and sort of like where you are born determines a lot of your healthcare risks, if you go to certain areas of the state or if you look at census tracts, it will actually tell you that there are pockets of Idahoans where they just don't have access to healthy environments where they can do this, where they don't have healthy foods, they don't have transportation, where they can actually be out there and be active.
And Jean, talk to me about what policies have been working. In the last segment, we talked about having that collaboration with policymakers, with legislators. Can you name some certain policies that are working or collaborations?
I think right now we have to look at more of the municipal level.
Okay.
Getting mayors and city councils involved because really they can affect and impact what happens
so
in their community.
So it starts at that local level.
I think even before that, it really starts with a community uprising to say this: we don't feel that health is a shared value. And by that, we talk about health equity, which means that every person has an opportunity to live their healthiest life. Now, it doesn't mean everybody's going to take advantage of that, mm-hmm. but you
it's
give them
an
the opportunity.
Right.
And so when we look at some of those equity factors that Dr. Nekachea just mentioned, you know, when people are born into poverty, when they don't have transportation, they don't have access to healthy foods. All of those things compound, and then people also start to live in crisis. And I think Dr. Schall's mentioned that you're worried about feeding your kids sometimes, and you may not be thinking about a plant-based diet mm-hmm. if you have a hungry child, or you're not sure where you're going to sleep at night. And unfortunately, that's a reality for more people in Idaho than we probably imagine. And so we talk about looking at a zip code level, but really we're starting to even look more at the census tract level. For example, in Nampa, we're doing some work, and when you look at obesity as a whole in Nampa, it's really high at 34% with adults. But we look at particular census tracts. Mm-hmm. Census tract 202 is 41.5%.
Really?
So we could say 34% and, oh my gosh, that's a significant obesity factor. But then we look at a census tract level, and it's, you know, considerably higher, and then our physicians could tell you the potential impact to health from that. So we've really got to start partnering to Dr. Mm-hmm. Nekachea's current or earlier comment. We have to partner and we have to start figuring out how we make health a shared value mm-hmm. and really how we remove barriers for people.
Because simple things like putting a sidewalk in so someone can walk their child mm-hmm. to school makes a difference.
Absolutely. And as a parent, I really have never encountered a parent who doesn't want a better life for their child
right.
than they've had for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nekachea?
And definitely, you know, going back to the issue of helping fund some of these nonprofit partners that we have, we do have what is called a Community Health Improvement Fund, and we give grants to these nonprofit partners in the out there. More and more we're trying to look at nonprofit organizations that are not just doing really good work in the community, but also starting to use what they learn and their experience to support policies, because ultimately that will have a much broader reach in the community. So we are looking at that right now. That's the direction we want to go.
And Dr. Schultz, I wanted to talk to you about what some of those partnerships look like. Because there are some partnerships going on right now with nonprofits that are making a difference. Can you talk about any in particular?
Well, I might defer a little bit to Jean
okay.
For some of that.
We have some incredible community partners. I would mention Riggins. Riggins, their really closest larger community is mm-hmm. McCall. But a lot of people don't have transportation or they're older and they don't feel capable of driving. So there's actually a shuttle that we've helped partner that comes up every week. and brings people to McCall. And so it's not just for healthcare visits. People can ride that and go to the library. They can go wherever really they want. And so what we're finding is that riders are feeling far less socially isolated, which that's another big predictor for health.
Right.
Is being connected to people, being connected to community. We partner with Create Common Good, and that's a fabulous organization that actually works on some of the social disparities for people. It connects them to employment. It connects them to skill building, and connects them to a sense of purpose. So we have partners who work, you know, families against family advocates against violence. We have all of these partners who we can't, it's not a core competency for us. So we rely heavily on them to partner with us to really create a healthy community.
And Chobani is partnering with us in the Magic Valley on fresh food prescriptions.
And I have to wrap this up. I know we could continue talking. Thank you so much for your time today. We have been talking about the changing face of healthcare in Idaho and across the country, and community health and the importance for us of it. My guests today included Jean Mutchie, Dr. Jennifer Schultz, and Dr. Alejandro Nocachia. Thank you all for coming in today. I know we didn't get to everything, but I appreciate your time.